Blog Talk Radio.
OCO. You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the holy ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Atawehis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet, all for $9.99, formerly priced at $29.99. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files, and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keepers Preppers Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. Osio Ginalii Tahiju Toigu, which means, hello, cousins. I'm fine, how are you? This is your old buddy Bluewater coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau in east central Tennessee, the ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the old Cherokee Nation. Well, tonight, there's something strange on our show, and, well, the subject matter, not to say Kevin Smith's strange, and I'm strange, but anyway, welcome, Kevin. It's an honor and a privilege to have you on board. How are you tonight?
I'm doing very well, and pleased to be here, and I am, in fact, strange.
Well, we've also got co-host Mark the Badger Borcheting on board, and in case you have anybody has any questions about the Mayan calendar, but you know, I haven't been keeping up much on the UFO scene. I've been so busy with gardening and prepping, and you're going to have to fill us in on all the latest.
Well, the UFO scene has become really pretty complicated. Because there are misinformers, there are disinformers. A misinformer, as opposed to a disinformer, A misinformer is someone who really doesn't know what they're talking about, but they're absolutely certain they do, and they speak with great authority about it. Disinformer knows for sure what he's saying is not true, and either is doing it as a result of his own personal agenda, or perhaps he's being paid to do that, to create all kinds of havoc in the information so that it's difficult for people to sift and sort. And you know, then to come to a conclusion about what is the real story. But one of the most prevalent devices used by both is they will say, well, you know, most of what people are calling UFOs are really top secret military aircraft. And just think of what that implies. It implies that the person saying that has the clearance to know what most of those things in the air are.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't. And it's a specious argument. Just south of Phoenix, Arizona, I used to live in Phoenix, and just south of Phoenix, Arizona, is a place called South Mountain. Today it's a park. It's a municipal park, and it is the largest municipal park in the United States. It's out in the desert, and as the name implies, it is a mountain and associated mountains and hills with it. All through the South Mountain area, as you walk through that, there are petroglyphs. And these petroglyphs show what today we call UFOs.
Yep.
And they are hundreds, if not thousands of years old. No one knows for sure how old they are, and no one knows for sure who made them. But I have a friend out there who's somewhat of a local expert on those petroglyphs, and he says something that really makes sense. He said, you walk through here and you see these petroglyphs and you see these figures on the rocks, and people try to interpret those as all of it is some kind of religious mythology. And he said, that's not what that is. That's the videotape. They recorded what they saw.
Mm-hmm.
I thought about that, and I want to give you a real quick example of why we know that's true. If you have a pencil or a pen and a piece of paper, I want you to do this little exercise with me. The exercise is simple. I want you to draw. You don't have to be a good artist. Just do your best with it. I would like for you to draw a flammiflugy.
A flammiflugy?
Can't do it, can you?
No.
Because you don't know what a flammiflugy is. You can't draw what you have not seen. So whenever we see something on these petroglyphs that looks like what we're calling UFOs today, and we know there was no U.S. military doing secret, top secret, super top secret flights at that time, what are
yep.
we looking at? We're looking at what they saw.
Yep.
And so the phenomena is, I think we can say that the phenomena of UFOs is real. And how sure am I of that? I can absolutely and quite literally say rock solid.
Well, commenting on something you said earlier, I heard Art Bell say once that the UFO movement is the only movement he knows of that eats its own young. It's a nasty place.
Well, yeah, they do that. And, you know, it's... I think there are probably several other movements that do it too, but They do that, and part of the problem there, you see, is that within the so-called UFO community, it has become somewhat of a religion.
Yeah.
So that it's all about what people believe. Well, I believe in UFOs.
Yeah.
Well, why? Do you believe in doorknobs? You believe in beer cans? You know, I mean, either they exist or they don't. If they do, there's nothing to believe. They're just there. And but around all of this need to believe, that really is insecurity about being able to say, I don't know. You know, there's belief is what people use to fill in the blanks at the end of the data. But you can just as easily fill it in with, well, I don't know. So with UFOs, do I believe in UFOs? No, I don't. I don't believe in UFOs. I don't have to. I know they exist. I've seen them.
Mm-hmm.
I know they're there. I'm looking at the door of my studio right now, and guess what? It's got a doorknob. I don't believe in it. There it is. So, you know, believing in UFOs is not only a waste of time, it's really insecurity about being able to say, I don't know. Now, there are things about UFOs I don't know. I don't know who's driving them. I don't know where they come from. I don't know what purpose or agenda they may have. But I do know they exist. And, you know, so there's just no need to believe. But around all that need to believe, once you fall for that, then once, I don't mean you, but once somebody falls for that, then belief has to be supported by belief, which has to be supported by belief, and it is most often attacked by facts. And as the facts come in, it attacks beliefs, and then people start saying that people presenting the facts are debunkers. And, you know, that they have some kind of nefarious agenda. But I'll tell you this, most of what we see that people think are UFOs are not top secret military craft. And we know that because back before there was a United States, and definitely before there was a United States Air Force, we had indigenous people here in this country carving images of those craft on rocks. So they've been around for a long time.
That's absolutely correct. And then I've had some strange experiences. I left a voicemail for you for a little bit of the stuff that's happened to me, and it's hair raising. That's all I got.
Well, it would be hair raising for me too if I had any hair, but I don't. So. But look, you know, the nonsense cover stories that have come out over the years have been treated with respect by people in the UFO community, and they treat them with respect because they want to believe, they want to respect and to believe in the basic integrity of these people wearing uniforms with rank or some politician that's been elected. They'd like to believe that these people would not tell them a lie. One of the things, I guess, that's kind of a hallmark of what I've been doing is I take a cover story, analyze it, and every flaw I find in the cover story, I hit them between the eyes with it.
Well, see, that's your
and,
cop.
And they used to attack me for that. I used to get a lot of trouble. Interference with the show and stuff like that doesn't happen much anymore.
Yeah.
Because I think it's because, I don't know, but I think it's because they figured out, you know, they've been trying to put the show off the air for 11, almost 12 years. I'm still here. I won. and well, I bite back.
Yeah, well, you're a seasoned investigator, and I encourage folks to go on over to KevinSmithShow.com and take a look at your background. And there's also a blurb on the show page about what you're all about. And but yeah, it's a highly charged subject. I've had some really strange experiences, and oddly enough, you know, I started. I guess my first one was about 8 years old. I don't know if you want. Do you want me to launch into my UFO stories?
Sure. Go ahead.
Well, my my dad worked in aerospace. He had a rating as a NASA research scientist, and he had a Q clearance. They wouldn't take him in the Army in World War II because he was too skinny. His brother was a 1945 Annapolis grad, and he retired in 1980, had an office at the Pentagon. He was offered flag rank and turned it down, and he was on short list for the Pentagon. So it's an aerospace background, and I my earliest, one of my earliest hobbies was astronomy. I used to be an amateur astrophotographer, and I'd go out and spend a lot of time out at night. So I was a trained observer. And, oh, gee, you know, Dad, there was the story that my dad told me about my dad and my mother's brother. They said that they were on a trip between Houston, Texas, and Vicksburg, which is where my mom was from, and they were shadowed by a UFO, probably back in 1959. And so I grew up, you know, hearing Dad's experiences, and Dad said that when he was at Wichita during World War II, he worked for Boeing, and they had him escort the prototype magnesium nose casting for the B-29 bomber to Wright Patterson, and he saw something in a hangar. Didn't quite know what to make of it. And so, you know, I grew up hearing these stories, but when we moved from, we moved to California in 1962, we took off from, we were in Denton, Texas, I think the second night, and on our way west, and Dad used to like to get up like 3 o'clock, 3:30, and get us all up and be on the road by 4, because he liked to drive at night, and I used to, I'd sit in the front, and sister and mom would, you know, be nodding off in the back seat, and I would put my elbows up and look up at the stars. And one night I saw something overfly us. It wasn't lit up, didn't have a corona, but I noticed it had three ventral fins on it. It was cigar shaped, maybe 50 feet long. Dad didn't see it, but the lights dimmed in the car, and the hair went up on everybody's arms. And he said, "What was that?" And I told him what I saw. And it was, oh, it was probably moving a couple hundred miles an hour. It was, and from time to time, oh, geez, I'd see, well, okay, and then the next strange experience I had, I was living on a mountaintop. Let's see, this would have been in 2002, 2003, something like that, living on a mountaintop, in Missouri with some Indians, and the chief of this incorporated tribe, he knew, you know, 2-3 nights a week he'd say, "Hey, I got a feeling they're going to be out there," and they'd usually show up about 9:30, and they looked like yellow flares, but they didn't fall, they didn't have sparks flying, and it was usually two of them, and they usually stood over a wilderness area that was about 20 miles north of us. We were in Van Buren, Missouri, And some nights, you know, we'd hear the choppers coming in, and then they would lead, they would wink out and move a couple miles usually to the west, and they'd wink back on. And one night we saw them, because we were sitting, you know, we're at a real high place in Mark Twain National Forest, and we saw them do a huge circle. They probably went as far north as St. Louis and came back and stood in the same place. So we had those kind of hijinks. But one night, the chief didn't know a lot about constellations, and I did. And we used to sit out a lot at night about 10:30 at night, there was to our behind us. We were looking basically north and a little east, and behind us was just the very last rays. You could barely see the sun. The sun was down, but you could barely see the last purple rays. And I was trying to explain, you know, where Vega was, and I said, this is a very prominent star and constellation of Lyra. And, well, where is it? You know, and I said, well, that's, there's a satellite, Fast Walker. Could you see that moving? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, I think in about 10 seconds, it's going to be right by Vega. And so we actually counted down 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2. And when I hit zero, a light swept out from the opposite direction of travel from whatever it was, and swept down on us for about 5 seconds, and it was as big as the moon. And there we're sitting there with our jaws open, and that lasted for about 5 seconds, and the light went off, and it went on its merry way. And I thought to myself, well, the sun was behind us below the horizon. You know, the thing must have had a, if it was a satellite, maybe it had a loose solar sail, but you know, I couldn't explain it as any other way than some kind of mental contact with it. And the reason why I had that impression was back right around my son's eighth birthday, which would have been 93, we were living in Fredonia, Arizona, and that area was famous for it was the Arizona Strip, and there was a lot of aircraft flown in that area, and a lot of aurora sightings, supposedly. And one night, it was about midnight, we were coming home from St. George, had seen a movie, and just as we're getting out of the car, we're getting ready to go into our 35-foot fifth wheel, and I said, hey, look directly to the north, and I pointed. I said, and I was kind of joking, I said, hey, JoJo, my son, I said, you know, maybe that's a UFO. I said, let's think, hey, if you're a UFO, turn your light on when you get to the zenith. And you know what? It did.
Yeah, so, well, see, there are lots of stories like this, and not just a few. There are stories like this all over the world, and they go, they're not just in modern times. They go way back, you know, this thing about U.S. military crafts, they would not have that capability, there are people who say, and I'm saying this for the benefit of your audience, there are people who say, well, I don't know whether I ought to believe that or not. Who cares whether you believe it?
Yeah.
See,
well,
here's the thing.
Go ahead.
Here's the thing. Believing something is not going to make it more true. And if it is true and you choose not to believe it, that doesn't make it less true. So belief is completely irrelevant.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me tell you about two more, and then I'll shut up. I was living in American Fork, Utah, which is about 40 miles south of Salt Lake, and my wife set me up to Fred Meyer to get some sanitary napkins for whatever. And my practice was I'd pull into the driveway and look up at Polaris and maybe pray. Well, one night, this little thought crept into my head, turn around and look south. And I did. Now, this was a poor area. American Fork's a very rich area, but this is a poor side of town. They didn't even have street lights. There were lights a couple, three blocks away at the park, and there was a ball game going on. This is about 9, 10 o'clock at night. And all of a sudden, I saw something move, and I was facing south at this point, or no, west at this point. And it was south. And I saw something moving, maybe about, 75 to 100 feet off the ground. And I thought, well, that's a strange bird. You know, I said, it looks like a mirrored ball. And then all of a sudden, this huge flying wing, I would say it had a, and if I hadn't been prompted to turn around and look up, I wouldn't have seen it. But it was a flying wing. It had two pipe-shaped nacelles. I'd never seen anything like it, you know, ever represented. And it was, following about 100 yards behind whatever was in front of it. And it completely blotted out. I would say the wingspan was a couple hundred feet. And and then I've also, my family, we've also seen, I guess what some people call survey craft. I understand that they're a kind of a mirrored ball, and they're huge, like a blimp, but round, and they have three bottom lights on them. I've seen those twice. And but back in if you'll Google UFO triangle Walsenburg, Walsenberg, Colorado, on the 19th of October, I reported to MUFON. I was walking out to an RV that I was sleeping in, and I saw, of course, the interstate was just, you know, we lived 100 yards from the interstate, and I saw this something coming down from the north, and I noticed it didn't have nav lights. It had white lights. It was an isosceles triangle, it seemingly. It had white lights on each corner, and it had a red light in the center, more or less, of its belly, but it had kind of an amorphous ball up near the nose, right now at the tip, but kind of off to the side, and kind of a bubble. And the MUFON guy I spoke to said he believed that that was a new generation of, you know, what they call the TR-3B, and he believed it was a government craft. And but anyway,
well, they do exist. Yeah, they do exist.
But yeah, it's really something, and yeah, they do, and you know, my Cherokee traditional teacher John Redhunt Duke was an Air Force officer for 30 years, and he lived he had a ranch out near the Air Force Academy, and spent a lot of time at Cheyenne Mountain, and but because he was raised in the traditional Cherokee culture and lived at Laguna, New Mexico, near the Laguna Reservation, he said, you know, the Pueblo culture, he says, it's just a foregone conclusion that they exist. It's no big deal. Robert Morning Sky, you know, wrote about a crash survivor that they nurtured back to health some years ago. And so anyway, yeah, I thought I'd share that first, you tell me what you think.
Well, I think you've given proof of what I was talking about, and that is, you didn't tell me anything you believed. You told me what you know. And that's really important. The reason I'm hammering that is because you had asked, when we started out, for me to just sort of, you know, you said, what's going on in the world of UFOs or something like that. Well, we need to re-anchor. People who are interested in UFOs need to re-anchor and stop being just tossed to the left and tossed to the right, and because, you know, you're going to be tossed overboard. All of these weird things that keep getting introduced to the world of UFOs, and then you hear people talking about how important it is that, you know, we believe in this stuff. Belief has absolutely nothing to do with it. You need to anchor to the facts. The facts are they do exist. And as a matter of fact, the federal government has admitted, the military has admitted, they exist. I'm sure you're familiar with something called Project Blue Book, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, you see, almost every time somebody talks about Project Blue Book, if they are on the side of debunkers, they say, well, you know, Project Blue Book proves that, you know, they just they gave up the search for UFOs and the investigation for UFOs because there was nothing to it. And, you know, 95% of everything they looked at had a normal explanation. And if they're on the other side, people who think UFOs are real, usually what they say about Project Blue Book is it was a whitewash. It was never intended to get to any answers. So both sides diss Project Blue Book. But here's the facts. The facts are 95% of everything they looked at was proven to be explainable. That leaves 5%, doesn't it?
Yep.
How many elephants does it take to prove elephants exist? Only one elephant. And here we had 5% that were left as unknown. Well over 1,400 cases. And these were the cases that had the best witnesses, pilots mainly, and detailed technical description. They had the best data for these, and they left them as unknown. They couldn't explain them away because people who had technical qualification had described them technically.
Yep.
And so they left those as unknown and published their report that way. So what does that mean? That means that Project Blue Book concluded that they exist.
Well, I guess the British supposedly came to the conclusion, well, then they don't seem to want to hurt us, so they just stopped spending money looking into them. But we've got astronauts, you know, people as they get older, you know, a few years before they die, they lose the fear of, you know, what's going to happen, are the men in black going to come shoot me or whatever. But I understand, you know, that there's this document, this Majestic 12 document. It's a protocol. You know, it looks like a U.S. Army training manual or document. But basically, supposedly, it says that, you know, if you've been contacted or seen a UFO, you know, that you're classed as a different kind of person and can be treated differently. So it's a scary subject. Particularly if you know your paycheck comes from the U.S. government, but you know the Russians. I mean, they don't. You know, they talk about a lot of things openly. You know, UFOs and Planet X, and they seem to be much more open in some ways than our society.
Well, let me tell you something. The Chinese are too, and nobody should. By any means misinterpret what I'm about to say, but most of my international experience was in countries that were ruled by dictators.
Yeah.
And that included the former Yugoslavia, which at the time was being ruled by Slobodan Milosevic. And what you get told here about the conditions there and how the people have no freedoms and they're slaves to the state and all of that is not true. He was a bad guy, in my opinion. There's lots of bad guys, some of them in our government. But he was a bad guy, and I'm not defending him. I'm just saying the picture they paint for you in the news about these other countries is not accurate. And the people were absolutely not slaves to the state. And by the way, when they had had enough of Milosevic, they took him down. It wasn't on the outside. It was they themselves did it. But Russia, China, virtually every country on the planet is more open and transparent about UFOs than we have here in this country. And, you know, I don't know why that should be the case. I don't know why it is the case, but it's a reality. So here in this country, everything we find out about UFOs, everything we can know about UFOs, pretty much comes from people who are independently investigating UFOs.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and you know, my friend Tom Chittum, you know, he fought as a volunteer for Croatia, and yeah, he'd agree. People don't, unless you live in a place you really don't understand how it works, but he firmly believes that this country is in danger of becoming Balkanized also. But that's pretty much what I heard from him, too.
Well, you know, Croatia's a beautiful country and a wonderful country. I lived and worked in Zagreb, which is the capital city, for a brief period of time. And then when I was deployed from there down into Republika Srpska, which is the northern, extreme northern end of Bosnia. And I was at Brčko, and there's a very famous bridge there, famous from the war. Right across the bridge is Croatia. And so I used to go across from Brčko over to Gunja in Croatia, because over there they had some great restaurants. And I would go over there. Uh-huh. And you could get actually the best hamburger you've ever had in your life at a place called Tatiana's.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, there's UFOs happening everywhere. And as a matter of fact, they're on the increase. They're on the increase. UFO reports are increasing every year. So I think, you know, we're probably headed toward some type of a climactic event with these UFOs. And I think it's going to be something where no government is going to be able to continue to hide the facts. I think the facts are going to present themselves.
Yeah, that seems to be the feeling that most people get, is that it's something is imminent. And you know, I also heard, I read a book years ago called Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow by, Constance Cumby. And, you know, she was of the opinion that, you know, that this thing could be turned into a religion and could be used to manipulate people, and that holograms could also be used to make people think that certain things were happening, and so the religion end of it, yeah, it's kind of dangerous as far as I'm concerned, because organized religions seem to leave a big hole in a lot of people's hearts, and they're out looking for something, and you know, if you can go to BibleUFO.com, it's amazing how much evidence there is in the Bible. And I had a friend in Utah years ago. He asked me to open up the Book of Revelations, and I can't remember which chapter. It's not a very big book, but he said, start reading here. And apparently John looked up, and he says, behold, a door opened in heaven, and he says, there was a trump. And my friend said, he says, trump's like a loudspeaker. And it says, a voice said, you know, come up hither. And he was carried up into a round room, and the center of the room looked like a throne that was surrounded by what he thought was sardine stone. Well, sardine stones, you know, looks like that clear material that's not like that you see on the bridge of Battlestar Galactica. You can write on it. It has a kind of a rainbow hue. And there's 24 seats around the outer edge of the vehicle, but he says above the throne there was a picture of a man, an eagle, a lion, and something else. And my friend said, doesn't it possibly sound to you like could be a television monitor? And my friend Robert Ghostwolf actually went into the bowels of the switching now to the what happened at Walker Lake in 1889 and 90 with the ghost dance, where it was reported that Jesus appeared and gave the Indians a dance and told them to do certain things. And all this information was in the newspapers, and a lot of it's on the internet. But what Robert said isn't on the internet is that when Jesus arrived, he was in a gold-colored kind of a donut-shaped vehicle that floated above the ground. And that when he stood up, seams opened up in the sides of the donut, and stairs just flowed down. You probably haven't heard that story. And
I have to admit that's one I haven't heard, but it doesn't astound me.
Yeah.
You know, lots and lots and lots of ancient documents talk about UFOs and extraterrestrials, and a lot of people. You mentioned BibleUFO.com, and you're mentioning about Revelation. In our country, a lot of people, millions and millions of people, believe or say they believe that the Bible is factual and that it's the Word of God. And then I hear from a lot of those people, I get email, lots of email, and I hear from a lot of those people how dead wrong I am about extraterrestrials, that they're all demons and they're all evil spirits and we need to stay away from them. Well, think about this. All right, this book called the Bible has this, it's really 66 books. And the very first one in there is Genesis, and it has a story of creation. And if you ask Bible believers who created the world, they'll say God. All right, here's a question for you. Is God from here, or did he create here? If he's not from here, he's extra terra. Terra is the Latin name of this planet. So when we say extraterrestrial, we mean the origin is not from this planet. So the very God of the Bible is extraterrestrial. And then this same book talks about cherubim. And people say, well, that's angels. Okay. Are they from here? Well, if they're not, they're extraterrestrial. It also talks about seraphim. And people say, that's angels. Are they from here? Well, if they're not, they're extraterrestrial. So not all extraterrestrial beings are demons and evil. But if we're talking within the context of the Bible, then certainly some extraterrestrials are evil. And, what was Lucifer? He was a cherub. He was a cherubim, one of the cherubim. So he's extraterrestrial, but an evil one.
Yeah, and there's duality in everything.
Yeah, the problem in the world of UFOs, as I said, we have a lot of misinformers who don't really know what they're talking about, but are absolutely certain they do, and they inject it into the conversation with great authority. Look, you're Native American. I'm part Native American. So let's use an example. And I believe I heard you say you are Cherokee. Is that right?
Right.
And so am I. Now, our history is our history, and we don't need someone injecting made-up stuff into our history, because that dilutes our identity. It separates us from who we really are. Does that make sense?
That's true. There's one point I want to make. You know, people talk about the Nephilim, which means the fallen ones. It was translated as fallen angels, and angels is just messenger. And supposedly
what theologians say, but I read Hebrew, and Nephilim doesn't mean the fallen ones.
What's it mean to you?
No, it doesn't mean anything to me. In Hebrew, the definition of Nephilim is the ones who came down.
Right, right.
theologian said, "Oh, that means they are the fallen ones."
Well, these beings supposedly had a double row of teeth, and I understand that King David had two regiments of bodyguard, and that his closest regiment was they were called the Gibberim. That's where we get the word gibberish from, because they made, apparently had a different language and can make different sounds. But I believe there's good ones and bad ones, because if you've heard the story of the peacemaker, Daganoweda, you can read this on the Canadian National History website. It said that Daganoweda meant double row of teeth. And this is a humanoid, looked like an Indian, but he floated across the Bay of Quinte in a stone canoe and arrived, and he was a lawgiver. He stopped the warring among the six nations, established a government, and they're certain that this happened 1,100 years ago, because there was an eclipse that happened at a certain time of year in that place, and they're able to wind the cosmos back and figure out that this did happen. But oddly enough, that type of constitution, which by the way, if you believe Benjamin Franklin, our own constitution is in part based on the Iroquois Guyana Shigawa, or the Great Law. But Icelandic people also developed a constitution very similar about the same time. But Daganoweda means double row of teeth, and I believe he was a Nephilim or somehow associated with them. And these, mm-hmm. these.
Yeah, well, there are very, very few documentary texts that tell us anything about the Nephilim. But there have been, of course, skeletons that have been found where they had double rows of teeth, and
yep.
they were gigantic. But the point I was making is that if you inject something, for instance, somebody makes up a fictional great chief and injects that into the history and begins to talk about it as though it really happened, over time, people get confused and they don't know, did that really happen or not? And you have some who believe it did and some who believe it didn't. And so it divorces us from who we really are and what we're really all about. Now, the same thing happens when you inject nonsense into UFOs or into anything else. It divorces people from reality. And this is why I say we need to re-anchor and stick with the facts. There are lots of facts, and just stick with them. And when you get to the end of the sentence, if there's still a blank, you get to the end of the evidence, if there's still a blank, you don't have to say, I believe this or that or the other thing. You can say, I don't know. It takes some more investigation. We'll see.
That's right. Well, the next, next question, I suppose. I guess there's no use talking about it, but there just seems to be this hanging expectation that. Let me run something by you. Back in, it's no secret that at night, in my sleep, I hear things and. Like in 1982, I was told that my wife was going to be an attempt to be made on her life during the dark of the moon. And that's exactly what happened 13 years later. And there's been other things. I was told in 1998 exactly what the weather was going to be like in 2005. Wrote it down, put it on the internet, and that's what happened. But back in 91 or so, it was right around the time of Ruby Ridge. And I remember listening to Art Bell. I believe it was right during that crisis. One morning I woke up and I heard the words, "Someday there will be a fake UFO invasion."
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess that was before Bob Lazar came out and started saying the same thing. And I wondered, who... And then I read that book, that said, you know, someday, you know, UFOs might be used to wow the population into submission or believing certain things or change their paradigm. And so I, you know, a little wary of what might happen. What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, do we have UFO technology? I think the evidence says we do. Now, what evidence is there? Real evidence. Well, we have the testimony of people who say they've worked on them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, listen, I hear people say this. Well, you know, eyewitness testimony is unreliable. Really? We have people on death row all over this country based on eyewitness testimony.
Yeah.
No, it's acceptable in court. It has to be tested, but it's acceptable in court, and it has a very high level of trust in court.
Well,
okay. The only place where people doubt it is when you talk about UFOs. All right. So we have these eyewitnesses. We have astronauts who have hinted that we have things you can't imagine. We have Stan Deo, who says that, yes, we've had UFO craft, flying saucer craft, since the 1950s. And he helped to develop the next generation of them when he was in Australia working for the Illuminati.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he says. Okay? So do we have the craft so that we would have the capability to stage a false flag?
Now, do you know who
I
Ralph Ring
is? I think the evidence is that we did.
You know who Ralph Ring is?
Yes.
Yeah, Ralph is, he's been a member of our Native Prophecy Council since the beginning. And I didn't really know who he was until recently, and I started the show back up again, and my gosh, he was involved with private research and building these things, and the government showed up and said, "Hey, you know, we're shutting you down. This is, you know, threatening the this is a matter of national security because it's a threat to the economic system of the United States, and you know, we've got the right to shoot you and all this other kind of stuff." And yeah, Ralph had an amazing story. I interviewed him about 3 weeks ago. There are people.
Well, there you go. There's another log on the fire, so to speak. I think you know, the evidence indicates that our government does have the craft with which they could stage a false flag like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, would they do it? I don't know. I will say that it's certainly not out of the realm of possibility. And, you know, it seems like our government operates on the idea that we have to have an enemy. We have to have a bad guy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like Canadian Bacon, the movie, you know?
Yeah, well, so... Let's get a bad guy that's not some other nation and scare the living daylights out of people, and they will run to the government screaming, "Save us, save us, save us."
Yeah.
And then they can gobble up what's left of your freedom and what's left of your wealth, your income.
What did you think of that Norway spiral thing during the Obama Nobel Peace Prize thing?
Well, I tell you what I don't think it is. I've heard all kinds of explanations about how that was a Russian missile gone astray. I don't think that's it. And, you know, it was up there for, like 20 minutes. Now, a Russian missile gone astray is not going to be spiraling up there for 20 minutes.
That's right.
I don't think that's what it was.
Oh, yeah.
The possibility that it was a wormhole that was generated by the HARP-type facility that's there in Norway, which is the largest one on Earth.
Well, then maybe that was an example of how the populace could be wowed, particularly during Obama's Nobel Prize thing. There was one other thing, the sighting I had, I forgot to tell you about. Back in 1976, I was a country musician. I was fronting a band for a Grand Ole Opry member. I was in Long Beach, and now I rarely drink, and I will admit I was standing on a corner. I had drank a half can of beer. But mm-hmm. Long Beach looks right out over the ocean, and I was up on a bluff and talking to a guy, and I remember it was the day after the last Chinese above-ground nuclear test. And we both saw seven craft flying in from due west. They were kind of a golden hue, golden orange. They're angular, as far as minute of angle, they were the same size as the moon, and they were traveling fast. They went from horizon to horizon, and let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 6 seconds, and then one of them came back. I would say they were at least 100,000 feet. They were high, and they were moving, and they were big. And then one of them came back. And right as it got to the zenith, it turned on its side, and so it was hard to see, and then it peeled right directly straight up and disappeared. And, I think that was my second experience. So, but it was right after that Chinese above-ground test.
Well, you know, if they were at 100,000 feet and they went from horizon to horizon in 6 seconds, that's way faster than anything man-made can fly so far as we know.
That was a guess. They were up, yeah. They were up there. They were at least 50,000, maybe higher. It's hard to tell.
We do have a craft now that I just read about in this past week that can fly so fast it'll rip the skin off the craft. Mach 20.
Mm-hmm. What's that, about 14,000 miles an hour?
I think that's a little above 14, mm-hmm. but generally 14, I think. And so they have to find some new way to put a skin on this craft so that it can fly at its peak.
Well, I know Colonel Duke, John Redhat, that told me that back in his Air Force days, he's passed away now, so I'm not going to get him in trouble. But he said he did do some secret work, probably for CIA. But he said he flew an F-111 with an iridium skin, which would have mm-hmm. allowed it to slip through the atmosphere with a lot less friction. And he didn't quote a mock figure to me, but he also mentioned at that he says, oh yeah, the F-111, great airplane. He says the German Air Force at that time. This would have been 2001 or two. Apparently, they were still using them in Germany. Iridium skin. That's pretty exotic stuff.
It is. But we do have craft that people don't know anything about. I mean, look, the Blackbird. The Blackbirds were in full production in 1962, and were in full deployment by 1966. And we didn't actually know anything about them until they retired them in the 1980s.
Yep.
And, it's still an amazing aircraft, absolutely phenomenal aircraft, can outrun missiles.
Mm-hmm.
But this aircraft existed for at least two decades before we knew it existed. And it was not only existed, but it was deployed and being used. And so, yeah, we've got aircraft that we don't know anything about, and I'm absolutely convinced that we have aircraft that have both conventional engines and electrogravitic, which I think most people call that anti-gravity.
Right. Something to do with plasma technology or something.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure we've got them. And so, you know, a false flag, yeah, it could happen.
Hey, listen, we're halfway through. I'm sure you appreciate a pause for the cause. Let's play Robert Robertson's The Lights, which I played, a few seconds of at the beginning of the show, and a little under 6 minutes, and we'll come back. How's that sound?
Sounds good. I'll get some coffee.
Okay. Here we go.
Just on the ice.
Well, we're back. We are back with Kevin Smith, and got some kind of noise problem. Hang on. Anyway, we're back. Are you back with us yet, Kevin?
No, I left.
We just got back. Hey, Mark Borcherding, our resident Mayan calendar expert, he got a question for you.
All right.
Hey, Kevin, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yeah, kind of back in line with Blue Otter said earlier about him seeing something and kind of thinking to it and gaining a reaction.
Mm-hmm.
I had some similar type experiences like that. And what I'm wondering is, in your research and work and efforts, have you seen more information and connections like that between consciousness and UFOs?
Yes. I forget the year, but I'm an old guy and I forget stuff, so that's what I do mainly for a living now, is forget stuff. But I think it was 2009. I believe that was correct. I was speaking at a conference in Sedona, Arizona. And this conference was being sponsored by Ed Grimsley, and it was Ed Grimsley's Skywatch Conference. Now, Ed Grimsley is the guy who discovered that if you use high-grade night vision equipment, you can see UFOs flying in space above the Earth almost every night. Lots of them. So we had been, on a particular night, it had been raining all week, but on this particular night of the conference, it cleared off, and he was going to do a sky watch with everybody at the conference. And he had a bunch of night vision goggles for people to use. And we had been outside earlier looking up, and there was no activity. When we walked out with the night vision goggles and everyone started thinking about, I want to see a UFO, they started appearing in great numbers, and there were so many, and they were so bright that you didn't have to have night vision. You could see them with the naked eye. And I think that was a result of everybody saying, I want to see them. You know, it was kind of interesting too. There was these are people who are very pro UFO in their outlook anyway. But a lot of the folks that are interested in UFOs have never seen one. And there was a guy standing behind me, and I was watching one with a naked eye, and he said, I started hearing somebody say, "Oh my God. Oh, my God, I cannot believe what I'm seeing. Can you see this?" You know, and so people were very, very excited. And the more excited they got, the more activity there was.
Huh.
So, yeah, I think so. I think the people driving these things do have the ability to pick up on what we're thinking telepathically.
Well, it's electromagnetic. You know, our thoughts are, you know, we're most of the, here's my theory, most of the matter in the universe is dark, and everything has a magnetic field, including us, and we're all, our fields are all intertwined, and they're listening.
Mm-hmm. Well, your brain operates at a particular frequency, and when
Correct.
You think, you are transmitting when you think.
Yep. Absolutely.
Some people never transmit, though. You know that?
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, I've met a few.
Oh. Yeah. I don't think there's anything particularly mystical about that. It is an ability that I think we once had. I think it was innate. And I think we have lost it. And, you know, look at what has happened to society as more and more high-tech gadgets have come on. People think less and less, and when they do think, it's shallower. It's very hard for them to conceptualize things, but they can just play the hell out of a Xbox 360.
Yeah.
You know, the more technology we lean on as a crutch, the less we use our brains. And I think that as technology increased over the centuries, we lost that innate ability to pick up on what people are thinking.
I had another friend, also a Cherokee. I knew this fellow. He had it was a mutual friend of Robert Shrewsbury. If you do Google search for Robert Three Eagles, you'll see that he wrote a book about hidden mysteries. But quite a bit of what was in that book was the story I'm going to tell you. This man, whose native name was also Badger, I met him when he was in his 70s. And he told a story, and I spent a lot of time sitting in his front yard, you know, 2-3 times a week, several hours a day, and my wife would go shopping and drop me off there. But, you know, one day, after I'd known him for close to a year, there was a man sitting in the park in his front yard with him, and the guy said, introduced himself, and he pulled out of his pocket a FBI identification, and it had a diagonal strip across it. I believe it was red. It said retired. And he said, I want you to know, he says, everything that Badger's telling you is true. He says, I was the case officer when all this was going on with him. But what happened was, I want to say back, and maybe it was 51. Can't really remember the year. It was 90 when I was being told this. But this man lived, Badger lived out in, I believe it was Vernal, Utah, which is in eastern Utah. And he was a prospector, and he also owned a printing business that was pretty successful. And he said one day, he says it was December, and one, you know, late fall and almost winter, and good time to go out in the desert and prospect. So he says he loaded up his little Jeep, military surplus, you know, looked like a CJ. He said he had a couple 55-gallon drums of gasoline, a hydraulic jack, and some other supplies, and headed out south into the desert. And if you look at a map of southern Utah, you know that's near an Indian reservation. It's also something called the roadless area. Basically, there was nothing between him except for desert, between him and Green River, Utah. And this is also rumored to be the area that possibly the Area 51 was moved to. There are rumors about that. But anyway, he said that he was driving out in the desert, and there, he came upon a woman standing at a crossroads. And she had, he said to me, he says, well, he says, you remember Uncle Fester from the Adams family? I said, yeah. And he said, well, she kind of had a knee-length coat like that. It had a fur collar went around her neck and down the front where the buttons would be. And he said that her eyes looked strange. And he pulled over and said, you know, ma'am, you know, geez, is there a problem? And And she, in broken English, she said something like, well, my Shem is broken. And if you know anything about, and he didn't know anything about Sumerian stuff, but that's, the Shem is the word for ship. But anyway, she didn't know, he didn't know what was going on, and he put her in the vehicle, and she was pointing the way, and they kept heading south, and he just thought she'd broken down or something, and he was cold. It was cold, and she had a tool belt on, pouches on it, and she, oh, no problem. And she gave him a pill, and she said, here, this will keep you warm for 12 hours. And it did. He had to take his coat off, and he was in shirt sleeves, and it was, you know, in the 30s. And he said they got down to an area called Wells. It took him 20 or 30 years to figure out that was an old stage stop. There was an old ghost town at that time, and the interstate that runs between Denver and Salina actually runs right through what's the old Wells, Utah area. And they passed through Wells, went a few miles further, and they pulled around Twin Buttes. There was a circular saucer type craft. This craft had skidded along the ground for several hundred yards, and it was dug in. And he's incredulous at this point, and she said, well, come on, you know. And so they got inside the craft, and she pointed up. She said, we need to fix that. And Badger said there was a huge spoked wheel in there, and one of the spokes had slipped out, no doubt, during the crash. So he went and got his hydraulic jack, jacked this thing back up and got it in its hub. She said to him, push it. And he said to her, you're crazy. That thing weighs tons and tons. She says, it's light as a feather. Push it. And he pushed it in the direction that she told him to. And it started spinning faster and faster and faster to the point where, you could hear a faint whirring sound. But anyway, she explained that she was a watcher, and that she was there giving furlough to some other watchers that had been there on duty for 11 years, and that it was her duty to keep tabs on another group of people that they call the Dark Worlders. She said that her craft was forced down by the Dark Worlders, and that they had taken from her a box that contained records of the 1,000 top scientists in the galaxy, and that it was to be given to native people to be used in the coming near destruction of the planet. After they got the ship running, they located these people and they forced their ship down. They fled the ship. He went in. He described the controls as being crystalline in nature. He took a big pipe wrench that he had with him and destroyed those controls. And as he was running back toward, this person's name was Ayelawan. And as he was running back toward her ship, he saw what looked like green blobs coming from behind him. And at one point he felt like he was hit and tumbled into a ditch. And next thing you know, he woke up and he was on her ship. And they went for a ride. And she showed him the Earth, flew around the moon, and brought him back. They did get this box, and he described this. Now, get this. This is 1951. He says that the records were kept on discs. And he says, well, you remember those bubble gum packages when we were kids, and if you moved them a little bit in the light, they kind of looked like a rainbow. I said, sure. And he said, well, he says, they were round, about, you know, 6 inches around, and they had a hole in them. And he says, you put them on a spindle on a turntable, and then you moved a little arm over, and he says, and a little, I think he said a green or a red colored light would shine down. And he says, then there was an apparatus that you put on your head. And Ayalawan put this on his head, and he immediately started twisting knobs. And anyway, he saw a lot of schematics and everything fly by him, and she slapped his hand away from the controls and said, don't do that, you can hurt yourself. But they buried that box somewhere near those Twin Buttes, and he'd always plan on going back someday, but he never could, you know, exactly. It was years later. And well, anyway, there was a we had another mutual friend that kind of took over where I left off in Badger's life. And I got a visit from this fellow when I was in grad school in 1999 in Logan. He stopped by the house and he said, oh, he says, we had an interesting experience, Badger and I. I said, oh, what happened? He says, well, he says, we did a map study. We figured out where it was. We figured out that Wells was the old stage stop, and we got a topo map, and we could see the Twin Buttes. And we were going to leave at 6 o'clock the next morning. And he said, Badger got a phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning from a guy who claimed to work for the USGS. And he said, I just want to warn you. He says, I was at a meeting of about 30-some-odd people. He says, there's microphones in your yard. We know what you're planning to do. If you do go and retrieve the box, we're going to take it from you. And he says, I just want to give you a heads up, because if, you know, if you don't turn it over to us, we will, you know, you could be harmed. But by the way, and that's basically the end of the story. But we do have a caller. Caller, did you have a question? What's your name?
Chris, I'm just listening right now, bro.
Yeah. Did you have a question for Kevin?
I didn't. I just barely tuned on. I'm just seeing what y'all are talking about and stuff, bro.
Okay. Well, I'll put you in the back of the screening room, and you can listen to it. If you have a question, I'll check back with you, okay? Or just call back, okay? Just call back.
All right.
Thanks.
That'll work.
Anyway, what do you think of that story, Kevin?
Well, it's entirely plausible. Entirely plausible. You know, again, these days, a lot of people hear a story and they immediately run to, well, I don't know if I believe that or not. Nobody asked you to. You know, nobody asked you to believe anything. There's not anything to believe. You know, it is the testimony of, it's your testimony, and your testimony of what he told you and what you observed, and I think it's entirely plausible.
There was a bit more to the story. He said that that he developed some kind of radiation poisoning, and he was in the hospital a day or two later in nearby, and then his wife also contracted some kind of radiation poisoning. They were both in the hospital, and Ayalawan showed up with a couple of guys, dark suits, sunglasses, and gave them both a large pill. And they got better and were released less than 24 hours later. And she promised to look in on him from time to time. And that is, you know, everything I remember. Now that, like I said, if you look up Robert Three Eagles, you can, there are copies of his books. It's out of print, but you can, he actually wrote down this this story. And it's called The Search for Knowledge and Unsolved Mysteries. And there may be a few nuances in there that that I can't remember. But just Google Robert Three Eagles, and you'll see a website called Search Skybirds. And that you can still get that book. So it's about $35 out of print now. So anyway, sorry about that.
Well, you know, there real events like this happen. And reality, if you stop and think about it, is better than any Star Wars script. I mean, we tend to think of ourselves as being like the most advanced of all humans who have ever lived, and that's nonsense. We're really pretty primitive. We're just barely crawling out of the Stone Age compared to these people from other parts of the universe who have come here. And they are as human as us. Some of them are not. Some of them are some other species. But a lot of these extraterrestrials are humans just like us. And, you know, we're not the front bumper of technology here.
No.
You know. When they get here, they must look at us and our technology pretty much like we look at Stone Age hammers.
Yeah.
And, yeah. You know, so, but reality is far more interesting than the fiction. And the problem is that we've been programmed to not think. And we've been programmed to fear. There's a great fear of the future. And I don't understand that because, you know, the future is fiction anyway.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as future. It doesn't exist. And there's no such thing as the past. It doesn't exist. I mean, there are memories of what happened, but remember that when it happened, it was present tense. And the future is, when I say the future is fiction, what I'm talking about, see, most people, when they think of the future, they're thinking of something that's like way out there, you know. It can be like next month, or the future is 10 years from now. Okay, it's something out there. That's not, that doesn't exist. What does exist is that every single nanosecond that ticks by, every nanosecond, it was the future 1 nanosecond before.
Yeah.
So we're living the future. And when we fear this thing called the future, we're fearing a ghost that doesn't exist. Let me do an experiment with you. I'll show you how this relates to UFOs and how it relates to the story you just told about this lady who was a watcher. But let's try this and actually do this. I'm going to do it and you do it.
Okay.
Okay? I'm going to count to two. On two, I want you to clap. Okay? One, two. All right. What you did on two was the future when I said one. Did you die in between?
No, I sure didn't.
Okay, so there was nothing to fear. In fact, as I did the experiment, you didn't feel any fear at all, did you?
Nope. A little exhilaration and anticipation, because it was fun.
Okay. Yeah, okay. So here's the deal. The future is what's happening to us right at this moment. Perhaps I should say the present tense is fiction, because the future is happening every nanosecond. Every nanosecond, I burn the nanosecond that I possessed, and a new one takes its place. So that's the future coming in and dying. What I do with that nanosecond can direct what happens in the next nanosecond. That means I'm in control. of the future. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Now, there are things that are going to happen on a scale far beyond my control. A tornado can come through. Earthquake can happen. Huge cataclysms, as some people predict for 2012. That can happen. If Nibiru is coming, and if we're going to crash with one of its moons, I don't know. There's nothing I can do about it if that's going to happen. Nothing I can do about it. But what I can do is control the nanoseconds coming into me.
Right.
And I can control them to the point that I put myself in the best possible frame of mind and perhaps the best possible physical circumstances to survive whatever happens. So I don't have to fear it. Now, how this plays with the Watchers, she said that they were here to control the Dark Worlders, right?
Yeah, just to keep them at bay.
Mm-hmm. Should we fear the Dark Worlders? Well, I don't. And, if the Watchers are watching and if they're doing their job, and by the way, the Bible talks about the Watchers.
Yep.
So for the religious folks who are not sure what they think about this, go look that up in your Bible. It talks about the Watchers. So if they're doing what they're supposed to do, then I don't have anything to worry about.
Right.
And what I need to do is concentrate on that next nanosecond and be successful in the next nanosecond. That's it. That's all I have to do. That's all I have to worry about. Just make sure I spend that next nanosecond right.
Hey, Kevin, have you ever had your Mayan birth sign worked up, given to you?
No, I haven't.
Do you mind sharing your birth year and month, day, and year?
Yeah, August the 14th, 1953.
Okay.
It's a great year. Great American was born that day.
August 14th of 53. Okay, did you hear that, Mark?
Huh?
Okay. All right.
Hello?
And
yep.
What does that do?
I don't
understand what that is.
What
will I find out from this?
Kevin? Can you hear?
Yeah, he can.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Well, what you'll do is look up your birth in the Mayan, particularly the Zolkin calendar, and it some people think of it as calendar. I think another description that you could say is that it maps out mathematic and geometry wise certain things into time, which are fundamental patterns in creation. But one of the things, one way I explain it to people, instead of a calendar, if you considered it a song, and each day was a musical note in the song, and if you know, you take your birth, and you know your musical note in the song, and its relationship to all the other musical notes in the song, it gives an idea of that type of relationship.
Okay.
Does that
I'm not
make
sure
sense?
I understand that. I think that's a little bit over my head, but then I'm a dinosaur, and I learn slowly.
Well, what I have for him is a 9 IMIX. IMIX.
Yes, that's correct.
Same sign as my wife. And the way this kind of works is you get a picture of what your challenges are, and if you overcome your challenges, what qualities you can that you can enhance in this cycle. And basically, in your worst days, maybe when you're – and so, some people overcome this when they're young children. Some people never overcome it. But in another life, maybe when you were younger, you could have been overprotective, dominating, and territorial. And maybe you struggle for security, had a problem with lack of trust. But I sense that simply because you're involved in this kind of research, you've overcome a lot of your challenges. So your qualities are enhanced creativity and inspiration, an intense need to birth new projects and nurture them. You have sudden bursts. You're like a crocodile. You lie still for a long time, and then you burst into activity. You bide your time. You control the situation. And but you're energetic, creative, protective, sensitive, but you can be dominating.
That's all very accurate.
Normally, Mark has got some other angles on this.
All right.
Well, the IMAX glyph is also is the first one, so it's a beginning. It has a tendency to be related to things with a left hand movement or energy pattern, which would go along with a
counterclockwise. You mean
counterclockwise spin? Yeah.
Okay.
Versus a clockwise torsion field spin.
Okay.
And it also tends to go with things with intuition and other senses that can be a little bit beyond what we call our normal five senses.
And by the way, let me interject. Counterclockwise is the way the Cherokees, Hopis, and Mayans dance. And that is the original direction of, according to the Hopis, that's the original direction of the spin of the Earth. And when we go through this next change, it will return back to that spin. And the physicists say that if this happens, then instead of energies being drained down away from you, that you will be getting energies from the Earth. And that possibly could account for how the so-called curse will be taken off of the land things will grow better, and we won't have any problems with weeds and negativity in the world. Just anyway, go ahead, Mark. I wanted to mention that, though.
Well, the next thing that comes up with him is a good ability to get a perspective of the big picture, especially when doing that, if it's accompanied with characteristic or thing of patience. So probably I would say since birth that's been something that's probably been one of the big keystones or cornerstones is that's really helped direct things and help him get that perspective is just the patience to move through things, perseverance, things like that. And helping on the insight. This also kind of tends to connect into completions of cycles, but we'll also make a connection here into between you and Blue Otter, because your birth is on 9 IMAX. The next glyph after IMAX is Eek, and Blue Otter was born on 9 Eek. The other thing that is somewhat interesting about this particular 9 IMAX is sitting inside of a 13-day cycle of read or bend and so that type of energy kind of governs the overall energy of all 13 days in that particular cycle. And that has a lot to do with authority and authority of power and that type of thing. So that coupled with the aspect of this big picture is kind of interesting. So, and what you were talking about how people sometimes mislead or something or misguide and they sound like they have authority, right? But maybe they really don't. Now hold on a second, bear with me. This particular 9 IMAX is paired with another day, and it is a kind of a counterbalancing within that cycle, and that's a Kaban glyph, 5 Kaban to be specific. One of the things that's interesting about this is between these is both Pakal's birth and death. The Mayan leader Palenque, whose tomb lid carving is fairly well recognized across the world, is one of the most, you know, well recognized piece of Mayan artwork. And your birth has is kind of in between these. So that might be something that you might want to look at and learn a little bit more about. Might learn something in there. The Kaban glyph has things about intelligence, knowledge, movement, wisdom, movement in particular. It is actually the glyph that governs the cycle that the 13 Bukhtan long count is going to end on. That cycle's actually start, 13-day cycles actually is a Kaban cycle, a movement cycle. And that that also couples in the Mayan tradition of Hunabku, the one giver of movement and measure, and the Kaban glyph is associated with that. That and the movement would also associate with, would connect movement, like how a UFO moves, and also Kaban is also connected to thought or consciousness. We have some information that seems to tell us that some of these ships not only interact with us consciously, but consciousness plays a very integral, if not major, part of the actual ability for some of those ships to even move, and how they move and where they move. So I suspect that all these things on your birth are kind of pointing to maybe why you've been interested in doing those things or looking at those things.
So what does that indicate, that I'm a hybrid or that I'm fully human or what?
It just indicates that, more or less what it's saying is it's just confirming what you already know, things you're doing, path you've been on, and you're more or less, you know, you're in the song, you're doing exactly what you're supposed to be doing. That's basically what it means.
Yeah, there's another Mayan-calendar.com about your birthday. It says that people like you tend to be teachers, writers, artists, politicians, psychologists, musicians, weavers, midwives, and poets. And you're a man of outstanding courage and strength, hard worker, great tiller of the soil. You could be a famous warrior, merchant, a man who's a good keeper of his wealth. You know, you're already doing all these things. And but, you know, you can become annoyed, and you can become strong, wild, and violent, too. You know, and I sent you a link to this. And it sounds like you're working your destiny. You have not stood still, and
I'll tell you, everything that both of you have said so far is very, very accurate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that can get me in trouble is if you give me a couple of pieces of the puzzle, I can tell you what the picture is.
Mm-hmm. Intuitive.
Well, that particular thing, what I'll give you a little bit of information is what's moving on what you said about the future in the next nanosecond. And this is what is essentially moving part of you that's existing in actually what we call the next world cycle or future, what is connecting now back to you probably. And it's exactly in this realm. And it's probably the things that usually when I look at people on this, it's something that can last anywhere from, it's not even far back, even say 1998 or somewhere around there or after there, tends to be with people I've looked at, tends to be things that it's been getting stronger, showing up more and more in life. And for you, it's things that have to do with intuition, abundance of things, opening up new paths, light, a lot with light, radio light, and especially these things connected in working with a intention of healing, achievement of things, and also an element of generosity or helping. So it seems to, that seems to be something that's going to be a real important components for you. It's coupled into the Mayan glyph of Akbal. And that particular, remember we talked about Pakal on your birth, the upper left-hand corner of his tomb lid, as you look at it, is cut. His two tomb lids are cut. They're marked for a particular reason. The upper left-hand, as you're looking at it, not from his perspective, but as you look at it, your left hand would reach up and touch it. That corner is that particular glyph. So I have a feeling that it might be helpful for you to do a little bit of research and look at that maybe and see what it tells you. There's also things coming up here as we move between world cycles. There's a some purification energy that's coupled in with your birth on your 9-IMX. And there's also something which I look at, and it's where the essentially a forward and backward time flow unite and come together. It's what I usually say is kind of like the doorway or bridge or gateway to move from one world cycle to another. And in yours, it's coming up with things having to do with ancestors, dimensionality, and things with family. And so the family could be the ancestors, both future and past, possibly both directions, and how this works in main the aspect of somewhat the what we think of as the illusion of reality. So I would say that and this might tie back into one of the reasons you're calling, talking about Blue Otter and the Cherokee background and the ancestors there. So there may be something, a key thing there for you to tap into on that, which is going to maybe help guide you a little bit more.
Very, very interesting. I didn't hear anything that's at odds with what I know to be me. That's curious and interesting. I've never had that done before.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And but now, what was your what was your birthday again?
August the 14th, 1953.
Okay, August 14th, 53. And I normally while he's doing that, look up somebody, and I didn't do this, but so we can do this in a minute. I look up your Torah portion. Now, were you born before or after sunset? Do you know?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, you're, you know, it is said in the Hebrew tradition that everyone's life is encoded in the Torah. And you heard about Bible codes. Well, this is a little snapshot of who you are. And here we go. And normally the very first lines of the reading has a lot to do with who you are. Well, this is Deuteronomy 16 and 18, which says, "Appoint yourself judges and police." And appoint yourself judges and police for your tribes and all your settlements that God your Lord is giving you, and make sure that they administer honest judgments for the people. And your Mayan astrology says you have absolutely no guile with it. You are absolutely honest and trustworthy. It instructs, it says, do not bend justice and do not give special consideration to anyone. Don't take bribes, since bribery makes the wise blind and the perverts the words of the righteous. So And then it just goes on, you know, pursue perfect honesty. So basically, it just indicates that that you are you would make a good policeman, and after that, a good judge, because you're an honest person.
Maybe he's going to be a watcher.
Yeah, and you're there's one other thing. It's called Haftarah. Now, your Torah portion is one thing, but that comes from the first five books of the Old Testament. And your Haftarah usually comes from the writings. And yours is Isaiah 51:12, which says, let's see. It says, I, even I, am he that comforteth you. Who art thou that thou art afraid of man that shall die, and the son of man that shall be made as grass? And I'll send you all this information on this so you can read into it. And it gives you a little snapshot. Of course, you know, this could cover a chapter or two, and there could be something in there that might help you on your way. I know it certainly got my attention when I was given mine, and it was a real eye-opener.
Well, yeah, and I'm pretty amazed, actually. Pretty
yeah.
amazed.
Yeah, it's fun.
But, you know, I said that if you give me a couple of pieces of the puzzle, I can pretty much tell you what the picture is. But I said, you know, that can get me in trouble sometimes. And, you know, really, you have to be very, very careful about how much you tell people when you know what's coming. You have to be very careful depending on who you are speaking to. Some people are able to handle it, and some people are not able to handle it. And then, of course, some people are just not of a mind to care. So that's something that I have had to learn over my lifetime, is to sort of know when to take my foot off of the gas pedal and just go easy, you know. Almost everything that people call the future is 100% predictable anyway. I mean, look, if you're in Chicago and you get on a train that's on a track that's going to Houston, where are you going? You know, you're going to Houston. And most of the future is predictable because people are on a track moving a direction, and we know where that track leads.
Well, earlier
most people never make any decision to get off of that track and go some other direction.
That's true.
And, you know.
That's all about discernment.
So almost everything we call the future is predictable.
Well, you mentioned your Cherokee ancestry. Do you know the surnames genealogy, the surnames that your Cherokee blood comes through?
I do not. And I'll tell you why. My great-great-grandmother was Cherokee, and quite beautiful, by the way. We have a picture of her. And she married a white guy who opened up a store in Oklahoma, and for all intents and purposes, she became white in her culture, in the names. She erased
right
her Cherokee past.
Very common. So you just have maybe your first name, or don't even know that at all?
Don't even know.
Hmm.
I just have a picture. That's all.
Do you have that?
We got that from my grandmother. My grandmother passed the picture on to us.
Is it a profile?
That's all we know.
Can you see her in profile or anything?
Can I see her in profile?
Yeah, is it a profile or head and shoulders? Or can you see anything of her,
no,
her profile?
It's full body and she's facing you.
Okay. Because there are some clans have certain hints. like the nose. You know, if it's a concave nose, that may indicate a certain clan.
Describe her. She had high cheekbones, angular face, and her nose was fairly straight and thin.
Yeah, if it was kind of concave, like a ski jump, that's indicative of the Couture or Wild Potatoes clan. The other marker is, of course, you know, she's passed now, but sometimes people of that clan have slightly webbed fingers, webs between their fingers. But it's hard to know. But, you know, you can have, get you in touch with Joe Sitting Owl over at AmericanCherokeeAssociation.com, and you can have your DNA done, and they may be able to track you right down to your clan. Donald Panther Yates is on the committee, and he's a former university professor at Georgia Southern, but he's doing DNA consulting out in Santa Fe, and we'll put you in touch.
Okay, that would be cool. I would like to know. As I say, you know, what we know now is simply that my great-great-grandmother was Cherokee, full blood. And as a matter of fact, in this picture, she's wearing traditional dress.
Wow.
But she married a guy that owned a store, and they apparently did quite well financially.
Do you know Do you know what town in Oklahoma?
You know, I can't remember,
yeah,
but I have heard. So that bit of information is available to us.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, we can certainly reconnect you with your Cherokee past. But hey, listen, we're about done with, and I want to thank you so much for being a friend and coming on the show. And if there's anything we can ever do for you, you just give us a holler, okay?
Outstanding, and I've enjoyed it.
And I'll say to everybody, it's important, you know, the elders say it's important everybody learn a little bit of Cherokee, and to say I love you in Cherokee, we say gageyui. And I'll say wado. Gageyui. I'll say wado, which means thank you, and ski, which means that's all I'm going to say. Anyway, folks, that's it for tonight. And we'll see everybody tomorrow night. We're going to be talking with Grandfather Lee over from Minnetonka and Roger Woblaze Labatt. It's going to be a really good show. And anyway, thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet, all for $9.99, formerly priced at $29.99. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keepers Preppers Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault.